From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As the nation honors the memory of Martin Luther King, we look at the civil rights movement today. The paradox of desegregation is that as the black middle class has moved out of the inner city, the black poor have become more isolated than ever. We'll discuss how that's affecting the movement today with Manning Marable, professor, syndicated columnist, and author of a forthcoming biography of Malcolm X. And we'll discuss whether traditional civil rights organizations have kept up with today's issues with journalist and professor Roger Wilkins. When he was growing up, his uncle Roy Wilkins was the head of the NAACP. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. French aviation officials report that a French airplane crashed tonight with 96 people on board. The wreckage was found after a four-hour search. There are some survivors. Initial reports suggest that most people on the French Airbus were killed, but that about a dozen have survived. The plane was on a flight from Lyon to Strasbourg when radio contact was lost. Rescue officials say the search was hampered by fog, the dense forest, and rugged terrain ranging from about 2 to 3,000 feet above sea level. Iran's UN envoy has denied a published report that his country funded Lebanese hostage takers. Linda Fasulo has more from the UN.
Iran's UN Ambassador Kamal Karazi denies that Tehran regularly financed and paid the kidnappers of Western hostages about $1 million for the release of each captive. In an interview on NBC TV's Today Show, Karazi admitted that his government had special influence on Lebanon's Shiite community. But he said this does not mean that they have been paid or the decisions have been made in Tehran. The Iranian envoy accused Israel of being behind the story and said that the Israeli government became angry after Western hostages were released, while Israeli captives or their remains were not returned. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
British Prime Minister John Major today rejected the resignation of Northern Ireland Secretary Peter Brook. The secretary had been criticized for a singing appearance on a television show just hours after a bomb planted by the Irish Republican Army killed several construction workers. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
Peter Brook's appearance on Irish television had been planned for months, and at the beginning of the interview, he forcefully condemned the IRA bombing that killed seven men, wounding seven more. But when pressed by the program's host, he agreed to sing a few verses of My Darling Clementine. Protestant politicians in Northern Ireland promptly condemned Brook's behavior as grossly inappropriate and demanded his resignation. In Parliament today, Brook admitted singing the song had been wrong, and he offered his apologies to the families of those killed. He then told Parliament he had offered Prime Minister John Major his resignation, which Major late in the day rejected. The IRA, meanwhile, last night warned of further attacks on civilians working for the British security forces. It claims such workers are collaborators and therefore legitimate targets. The British government has sent additional troops to Belfast following Friday's attack, the latest incident in the IRA's campaign to drive the British from Northern Ireland and reunite the province with the Irish Republic. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
It's election time in Israel. Now that the coalition government of Yitzhak Shamir has collapsed, the former prime minister has begun his campaign. Shamir is facing two main candidates for the prime minister's post, Labour Party leader Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin. Stocks closed lower on Wall Street. The Dow fell nearly 11 points to close at 3254.03. This is NPR. Deposed Haitian President Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide today said that military officers who ousted him last October would have to be exiled or imprisoned if democracy is restored in Haiti. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
President Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide said today he was confident that he would soon return to Haiti and that democracy would be restored to his Caribbean nation. Aristide is in Washington to meet Haitian Communist Party leader René Theodore, who is the latest choice to become Haiti's new prime minister. The Organization of American States is sponsoring talks between Aristide and the Haitian military to restore Haiti's civilian government. Aristide, who won democratic elections 13 months ago, also repeated his demand that military leader Raoul Cédras and other army and police officers who supported last October's coup must be removed from a modernized Haitian military. The exiled Aristide, however, ruled out a possible military intervention by the OAS and said economic sanctions would force Haiti's military to give up power. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Families of victims of the 1988 Lockerbie bombing today said that Libya was not the only party involved in the terrorist attack. They said that investigations into the roles of Iran and Syria were dropped for political reasons. Pan Am Flight 103 exploded in the air over the Scottish town more than 3 years ago, killing 259 people on the plane and 11 people on the ground. One family spokesman said that the evidence against two Libyan agents charged in the bombing was so weak that it probably wouldn't stand up in an American court. She added that the previous allegations had fingered the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, which is sponsored by both Syria and Iran. Georgia's interim prime minister today said that deposed President Ziad Gamzakourdia wants asylum in Western Europe. There are no independent confirmations of this report. Gamzakourdia returned to his home republic last week after spending 10 days in Armenia. His foes claim he became a dictator after winning general elections last May. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, Americans honor the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King. Some of his civil rights battles have been won. Segregation and racial discrimination are no longer legal. Nevertheless, they still exist. Blacks are still disproportionately unemployed, poor, and poorly educated. The problems are as profound as ever, but the movement is more decentralized, and there's no one leader with the vision and charisma of Dr. King. To discuss where the movement is headed today, we invited Manning Marable. He's a professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he's affiliated with the Center for Studies of Ethnicity and Race in America. He writes the syndicated column Along the Color Line, which is carried in black papers around the country. His political biography of Malcolm X will be published later this year. He's now writing a history of black political thought in the 20th century. Marable is 41 and came of age during the civil rights movement.
The movement in the 1990s is very different than the civil rights movement of my childhood in the 1950s. In the 1950s, the parameters of oppression were very clear. They read white and colored on signs on schoolhouse doors, at restrooms and restaurants, all across the United States, and not simply in the Jim Crow South. And the nature of the struggle for democracy was very clear to literally every African American throughout the country. The elimination of all legal barriers that kept us out of avenues of opportunity throughout the country. And that's why Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement of the NAACP and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and all of the great civil rights organizations of that era was able to mobilize hundreds of thousands of African American working class and middle class women, men, and children to go to jail, to lose their jobs, even in many instances to lose their very lives, because the nature of the struggle was simple.
So what is the civil rights movement today?
Well, right now the civil rights movement is caught in the web of its own history. Martin Luther King Jr. argued that the essence of the civil rights movement was the achievement of what he termed a colorblind society, in which blacks would not be judged, as Martin put it, by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Now, for the advocates of civil rights in the 1990s, that's been translated to say that the gains of the black movement today have to be measured in terms of what I call symbolic representation. That is, the more African Americans one can find in corporate suites, in the university administration, inside of the labor movement at the presidential level, and in the Congress, the more blacks you have in these positions, then African Americans at the grassroots level are empowered. Well, there's a problem with this theory. And the problem is very simple. Back in the segregation era of the 1950s, it was impossible for African American middle class people to escape the problems of racism and race that held down the bulk of the black community. In other words, if you were a black attorney in the 1950s, you didn't have white clients in most instances. African Americans were your clients. If you were a black doctor, you couldn't open up an office in a white suburb. You had to look to black working class and lower income people to be your clientele. I don't want to imply a kind of retrospective approval of Jim Crow segregation. Far from it. But there was a kind of perverse blessing in Jim Crow. And this perverse blessing was that it forced upper middle class and middle class black people to go back to the black community, to work within the black community, to build stores, to build schools, to build economic and social institutions. Today, that is much less true. Now African American upper middle class people can live outside in relative comfort in the white suburbs. Black middle class and upper middle class people are now in are located in white businesses, and for a tiny percentage of the black community, there is indeed the realization of Martin's colorblind society. And the irony is that for the vast majority of black people who are caught down by crime and by the proliferation of drugs, who are trapped by the economic crisis that's in our central cities, high rates of unemployment, poor schools, an absence of decent health care or any health care at all, deteriorating public housing and terrible public transportation that limits the ability of working class and low-income people to gain access to jobs which are now clustered in the beltways outside of our center cities. This means that the African-American middle class and working class and poor people have increasingly separate lives. And that has created a crisis of leadership and vision inside of the African-American community.
Well, when you look at black politicians, for instance, and there have been many more black politicians elected to office on the national, state, and local level, what kind of leadership do you think they're providing?
You know, that's the irony of the situation. The growth of black elected officials in the last 25 or 30 years has been astonishing. And yet the growth of African-American elected officials has not led to a concomitant increase in the political power of grassroots working class and low-income black people, in part because the whole essence of electoral politics is simply to re-elect a person to office. There is a sense within the black community that our voice is being heard in the centers of power. And yet the problem is that if there's no constraint, if there are no checks that the black community has organizationally on the behavior of those blacks whom they elect into high office, then there's no guarantee that people will carry out an agenda that actually addresses the basic economic and social problems of that constituency.
Well, in your writing, you've offered at least two critiques of black elected officials. You've criticized some for not having a meaningful civil rights agenda, and you've criticized others for merely being opportunistic and for manipulating the language of the civil rights movement without delivering on any of the content.
That's right. I think that many black elected officials are trapped in a political time warp. Their personal socialization and earliest political activities are linked directly to Martin Luther King Jr.'s period of politics, the civil rights era. And so they speak in a language of the civil rights movement. They think in terms of race-based politics, that is, a kind of politics that advocates issues related to race and racism. But in the 1990s and in the 21st century, the African-American community has to recognize that the legal constraints of the Jim Crow era that put us in the back of the bus legally no longer exist. And so what that calls for is a dynamic new agenda to revitalize the civil rights movement. If we don't have it, there will be greater political and economic fragmentation within the black community. We need a new vision and political agenda, and we simply aren't getting it from most black elected officials.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Manning Marable. He's a professor of political science and sociology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He also writes a column called Along the Color Line, which is syndicated mostly in black papers around the country. And he's also working on a political biography of Malcolm X. Where are you looking for new, strong national leaders?
Well, my own feeling on this is that The new leadership won't emerge until we redefine how we see the problems within the African-American community. We need to go beyond agendas which are narrowly defined by race or, as the old trade unionist used to do, simply problems defined by income or economic class. And we need to focus on what comprises a viable, humane, pluralistic, and productive community inside of our cities. And that's where the new leaders are going to come from. Most of our civil rights era was defined around agendas relating to race. We need to rethink this strategy and focus on what I call living space issues. Issues like housing and public transportation, health care and education, the quality of the environment, and child care. These are basic issues that affect the overwhelming majority of African Americans inside of our central cities. And we need leadership in these key areas that integrates all of these questions around a new dynamic program. Until that happens, we won't see effective leadership.
Well, those are much harder to organize around than one major issue like segregation. So I guess it seems like it would be very difficult to find somebody who could synthesize all of that and come up with an agenda that can actually be followed through. I mean, you know, how does one reform the schools? How does one create better housing? These are all really, really tough questions.
You've got it. But that is the challenge of the 21st century. And I think the other approach that African-American leadership has to take is that we've got to transcend narrowly defined race-based organizing where we think of our constituents solely as African-Americans, to recognizing that the United States in the 21st century is not narrowly racial, but it's multicultural, that we've got to look to the growing Latino or Hispanic population in this country that now amounts to more than 21 million people. You've got to look at the Asian population, which is 6.5 million, and 3.5 million Arab Americans as well.
Well, as you said, race in America no longer means black-white issues.
That's right. And I think that we have to see that as we enter the 21st century, that by the year 2056, according to the recent census projections, the majority of the total population in the United States will consist of people of color, and the white majority will become a minority. What does that mean in terms of an effective program for social justice? It can't simply be fighting against the laws of legal segregation. Those laws don't exist anymore. We've got to focus in a dynamic way on living space, human issues that affect all families so that we can affect a political coalition, a linkage between people of color and then many millions of white Americans who share these concerns around housing and health care and education and the quality of the environment.
You know, but as you're speaking of coalitions between different racial and ethnic groups, what's actually happening in a lot of cities is real tension between, for instance, blacks and Koreans.
That's true. And it's very tragic because what you get are two groups of victims blaming each other for their respective problems. Inside of the central cities and in Brooklyn, you get African Americans who are discriminated against in having access to capital by banks to start their own businesses. And they watch in silent resentment, and now not so silent resentment, as they see Korean entrepreneurs open up mom-and-pop stores in their neighborhoods. And they blame the Koreans for their poverty and unemployment. And yet, the studies on Korean merchants show that the average Korean business inside of a central city earns anywhere from $20,000 to about $40,000 gross income per year. So this is not AT&T and IBM. These Korean entrepreneurs are not the source of the problem of racism or economic discrimination suffered by black residents. And yet, their existence in the black community creates a handy scapegoat. Unfortunately for politicians and community-based organizers who should know better, because in the long run, as long as Asian and African-American community leaders and business people and organizers fight each other, then none of the problems of race and ethnicity and the problems that I've defined as living space issues will ever be addressed in an effective way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Manning Marable. He's a professor of political science and sociology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He also writes a syndicated column called Along the Color Line, and he has a forthcoming political biography of Malcolm X. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Manning Marable. He's a professor and the author of a forthcoming political biography of Malcolm X. Something that you've written about that's become a fairly recent phenomenon in some black neighborhoods is conspiracy theories, which try to explain the amount of drugs in black neighborhoods. The conspiracy theory says, well, the federal government wants a lot of drugs in the black neighborhood to keep black people down. There's a conspiracy theory about AIDS that says AIDS is really a kind of form of orchestrated genocide to kill off part of the African-American community. What explanation do you have, if any, for this phenomenon of conspiracy theories?
Well, we have to remember that there is a partial basis that justifies such conspiracy theories, that in African-American history there have been a number of instances where the federal government or other institutions have conspired to use incredibly inhumane methods of social control which have destroyed black communities or black families. The most notorious example was the Tuskegee Institute syphilis experiments of the 1930s through the 1970s, where in Tuskegee, Alabama, 399 black males who had contracted syphilis were supposedly treated by doctors, but they received no treatment. And the doctors were essentially using these black men as guinea pigs to see the degenerative effects of the disease within this population. So there's a basis for the sense of conspiracy in the black community. But the conspiracies of the 1980s and 90s are of a different order. There is a sense in the black community that the system, the political and economic and social power bases of this society have written off young black women and men. And the evidence that young people point to is the fact that, for example, in the 1980s, hundreds of thousands of young black men every year were incarcerated in federal and state jails, in prisons, that today 22% of all young black men between the ages of 20 to 29 is currently in prison or jail on probation or parole. So prison becomes a normative experience in a young person's life in the central cities, very much like being bar mitzvahed or getting a license when you're 16 years old. So in that environment, conspiracy theories really proliferate.
Do you consider the conspiracy theories very destructive?
I think that they're destructive mostly because they limit the vision of young people to see that conspiracy in and of itself doesn't explain or identify the real sources of the problem. It's not a group of cigar-smoking fat men in the back of some office building who are designing prisons or designing AIDS to project that inside of the black community, but rather it is within our own capacity to develop institutions that address specific problems in our daily lives that will liberate us. The new civil rights movement of the 21st century has to transcend the practices and policies of the mid-1900s, and we need to see that conspiracy is not going to lead to our survival. Rather, it's really the hard work of developing new institutions in which we consciously develop new kinds of leadership that's going to lead to the salvation of the African-American community.
But do you think conspiracy theories breed a certain kind of helplessness? They're doing it to us.
They certainly do. It's a sense of we versus them. And it leads to a political dynamic of insularity, of seeing yourself and your people against the world. And that kind of politics leads to a dead end.
Some of the gravest problems in African-American neighborhoods have to do with crime, drugs, teen pregnancy, unemployment. Some people blame that on the killing of the work ethic, a lack of initiative. What's your explanation for why crime and drugs and teen pregnancy have become such grave problems?
That's reminiscent of the thesis of Daniel Patrick Moynihan a quarter century ago, where he said that all the problems in the black community were attributable to African American women because the black family was matriarchal. And so we had to push down the black woman in favor of a more patriarchal society. Well, I disagree with the Moynihan thesis, and I certainly disagree with its new reincarnation, that the problems in the black community are all self-derived. I think that what that does is ignore the institutions of inequality and the institutions of discrimination that still exist in our society. You're always going to have problems of crime when young women and men do not have access to decent jobs in the central city. You're always going to have problems that will focus on the proliferation of drugs if you don't have an environment that instills in young people a sense that they can achieve and that there are real opportunities for them. So I think that if we piecemeal this approach toward the problems of the black community, we're not going to get anywhere.
Today is the day that we observe Martin Luther King's birthday. Do you have any thoughts about King that you'd want to share with us today?
Yes, I think that there are really two Martin Luther King Juniors. There's the Martin Luther King who has been frozen on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial giving his famous I Have a Dream speech on that hot August afternoon in 1963. And that's the King that everybody knows about. That's the King who led the Montgomery County bus boycott inspired by Rosa Parks. That's the Martin who led the Birmingham desegregation campaign and wrote the most beautiful document of the civil rights movement, the letter from the Birmingham jail. But there was a second King that we can't forget today. There was the Martin Luther King Jr. who came out with courage against the war in Vietnam. There was a Martin King who believed by the end of his life that there had to be a fundamental social and economic change in the country to address the problems of poor people regardless of race. And there was the Martin Luther King Jr. who was absolutely convinced that there could not be social justice in the United States unless the American government fundamentally changed its international priorities beyond Vietnam. And this King, the second Martin King, the King of 1967 and 68, is almost always forgotten on this day. Let's remember the two Kings and honor both legacies.
Well, Manning Marable, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Manning Marable is a professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His political biography of Malcolm X will be published later this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we discuss the civil rights movement of the 90s with someone who came of age in the movement. When Roger Wilkins was growing up, his uncle Roy was in the leadership of the NAACP. Roger Wilkins says the traditional leadership hasn't kept up with the issues of today. Roger Wilkins is a journalist and a professor at George Mason University. The civil rights movement today, coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A French airliner crashed this evening just before it was scheduled to land in Strasbourg in eastern France. Officials say about a dozen of the 96 people on board survived the crash. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
After a five-hour search for the plane, rescue workers finally found it near a mountain about 30 miles southwest of Strasbourg. Officials say the rescue operation is being severely hampered by heavy fog and strong winds. It's not known why the plane crashed. Airline officials said it disappeared from the radar a few minutes before it was scheduled to land. The plane took off from Lyon in southeastern France this evening as scheduled. The pilot did not send out any warning signals. The plane was an Airbus A320, one of the most modern commercial aircraft in service. There have been two other crashes of the same plane in recent years, but both were due to pilot error. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Officials in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia say that spokesmen for ousted President Gamsakhourdia have asked the new government to help him find asylum in Western Europe. The ousted leader returned to Georgia last week after spending 10 days in Armenia, where he had fled to escape armed attacks. So far, his supporters have not been able to organize strong resistance to the new military council. Opinion polls show a steep drop in the popularity of Russian President Boris Yeltsin following price increases earlier this month. They were his first steps of economic reform. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Moscow.
So far, there have been no massive protests over the price rises in Russia, but according to the Center for Sociological Research in St. Petersburg, President Yeltsin's approval rating has dropped to 22% in the city. In Moscow, new statistics published today indicate residents of the capital must now spend almost 2,000 rubles a month, twice the estimated average monthly salary, to ensure the bare minimum of subsistence. In Uzbekistan, students have launched an investigation into deaths which occurred as a result of last week's rioting over price rises. They claim 21 were killed by police. Uzbek officials have merely reported that several died. And at least two former republics, Azerbaijan and Turkmenia, have canceled planned price reforms, apparently to avoid unrest in their territory. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
In France, three television networks have announced plans to set up a new television all-news operation. The three said this new network would broadcast in France and by satellite all over Europe and North America. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 11 points to close at 3,254.03. This is NPR News. Israeli Prime Minister Shamir began his re-election campaign today with a promise to build more Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Speaking on the occupied West Bank, the Prime Minister told several hundred people that the West Bank and Gaza would remain Israel's forever and ever. Later at a news conference, the Prime Minister said that early elections would not slow down Middle Eastern peace talks in Washington. He added, it is his feeling that progress is being made at the peace talks. Across the country, there have been ceremonies today in memory of slain civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. King's hometown of Atlanta held a seventh King Day parade. Anna Maria Hartman of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Nearly 100,000 people were led through downtown Atlanta by King's widow, Coretta Scott King. She was joined by Winnie Mandela, the wife of African National Congress President Nelson Mandela. Mrs. Mandela used the King holiday to begin a tour of the southeastern U.S., where she will ask Americans to keep the pressure on South Africa until racial separation there comes to an end. Following the parade, the crowd gathered in front of the King Center for Nonviolent Social Change. There, U.S. Congressman led a rally criticizing President Bush, who visited the King Center last week and placed a wreath at King's gravesite. Other speakers, including actor Kris Kristofferson, urged Americans to vote against Bush for his lack of civil rights leadership. Martin Luther King Jr. would have turned 63 years old on January 15th. For National Public Radio, I'm Anna Marie Hartman in Atlanta.
In Denver, Colorado, riot police used tear gas to break up a counter-demonstration by Ku Klux Klan supporters that became violent. The confrontation occurred on a day when more than 10,000 people marched through East Denver to mark Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Five people were treated at Denver General Hospital. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. To help us focus on where the civil rights movement is headed today, we spoke with Roger Wilkins. The civil rights movement has always been a part of his life. His mother was a social activist who became the first black president of the National Board of the YWCA. His father was a journalist. His uncle Roy Wilkins was the head of the NAACP. Roger worked briefly for the organization and went on to become Assistant Attorney General of the U.S., a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial writer, and a columnist. He's now a professor at George Mason University in Washington, D.C., and writes a column for Mother Jones magazine. Wilkins describes the civil rights movement today as decentralized, with leadership coming from the traditional civil rights organizations, black elected officials, grassroots groups, fraternal and social groups, and black intellectuals. I asked him if he sees the lack of centralized leadership as a problem.
I think white people have always wanted to look at black America and say, X speaks for black America, and now we know what the agenda is, and now we know either what we need to do or whom we need to refute. And I think that that's been an impulse in local situations and in national politics. So the idea that, well, the leader is Martin King or the leader is Jesse Jackson or who is the successor to Martin King, those are white people's questions, I think. They're not black people's questions. We are a very varied people. And there are, I don't know, something like 32, 33 million of us. You can't expect there to be one leader. Can't expect us to have one single aspiration or set of aspirations.
So if the question of, like, who is the leader is really a white person's question, what do you think are the questions black people are asking now about the movement and about leadership?
Well, I think a lot of black people are asking themselves whether the old traditional organizations are serving the new needs of black people. The problems are much more complex than they were when I was a young man. When I was young, we had one big common enemy, and that was segregation and its gentler but still deadly offshoots in the North. Well, now it's enormously difficult, and it's a range of things. Some of it is just raw racism. Blacks finding it much harder to get mortgages than white people. In fact, a study by the Federal Reserve Board demonstrated that blacks in the highest income category were turned down more frequently than whites in the lowest income category when they applied for mortgages. That's just sheer, rank racism. In addition, the National Center on Opinion Research last year did a survey of whites and found that whites, by and large, believed that blacks were less intelligent than whites, less patriotic, less courageous, less hardworking. So there's a lot of the old-fashioned stuff, but it doesn't manifest itself, by and large, in the same old vicious ways. What I'm saying to you is that being black still affects the quality of life for all of us here in the country, but the sources of our discomfort or our pain are much more diffuse and much more difficult to identify, and therefore, it seems to me and to a lot of other people that our leadership organizations need to do a better job of analysis, of description, and of prescription.
Well, do you think that the traditional black leadership groups like the NAACP, the Urban League, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, do you think that they haven't changed with the times, that they haven't kept up with the issues? They've been criticized, for instance, for having leadership that is really aging and that younger people don't feel in sync with.
I would have to say that if you look at the leaders of the NAACP and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the National Conference of Negro Women, I'm about to be 60, and all these people are substantially older than I am. And I have been told emphatically by some of my younger friends and by my daughter, who is 32, that, you know, you're a useful fellow, Dad, but you're getting on. And I do think that in order for organizations to renew themselves, they have to encourage young people to take leadership positions. They have to be inviting to young people. They have to listen to young people. And they have to give young people a sense that their generation has a good chance of taking over the leadership in a reasonable time. And I don't sense that that's happening.
Do you think that there, I mean, even in the 1960s, a lot of radicals saw the NAACP as being kind of middle of the road. There were alternate organizations then. Do you think that there are strong alternate organizations now?
Well, the principal strong alternate organization in those days was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which has disbanded. There's also the Black Panthers, who were intellectual, radical, and sometimes gun-toting group, and CORE, which was at some stage moved to a more radical stance, which has virtually disappeared. You rarely see criticism of the mainstream leaders. And unfortunately, you rarely see statements, prescriptions, exhortations from the mainstream leaders. The people who speak most prominently about race these days are white conservatives. The responses, really, to the degree that there are responses from the black community, by and large come from academics. Now, I'm an academic, I like us. I think we do a good job. but it's not our job, really. It's our job to do analysis. It's our job to write and think. But it's not our job to be out there on the front line, rallying the troops, putting vigor into local chapters of these organizations. That's what the leaders have to do. And I just don't see it happening.
My guest is Roger Wilkins. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Roger Wilkins, and he's now a professor of history at George Mason University, a columnist for Mother Jones. He's formerly served in the U.S. Justice Department, the Ford Foundation, and he's been an editorial writer and columnist for the Washington Post. I want to get back to the traditional black leadership, the NAACP, the Urban League. Your uncle, Roy Wilkins, was the head of the NAACP, and when you were coming of age, he was already an executive in the organization. What did the NAACP mean to you when you were coming of age?
Well, from the time I was born, my uncle worked at the NAACP, and we lived in Kansas City, and I had two aunts and an uncle who lived in New York. My mother had two sisters who lived in New York, and my father had this brother who lived in New York. And my uncle was the tallest man in the family. He was taller than my father. He was taller than my grandfather. So when he came to town, there was this kind of tall man from this wonderful city, and he did these things, struggling for justice, struggling for decency for black people. And, of course, I lived in a segregated town, and I was bused to a segregated school. So I understood about the unfairness of racism, and I grew up with the NAACP in my blood.
When you were in college, you became an intern at the NAACP. What was it like for you to work in the organization? Was it addressing your interest?
It was when I was in law school, and the summer before I finished law school, I worked at the NAACP, and it was the summer after the Brown 2 decision, the implementation decision, summer of 55. So Thurgood sent a young woman named Alice Hartman, who was a same year in law school as I at Yale, and me down to the NYU Law Library to research the teacher tenure laws of all of the southern states, because they expected correctly that when the systems began to integrate, that black principals and teachers would be fired in large numbers. So Alice and I spent the summer researching the law and writing memos designed to help protect the job security of these black people. So it was great.
You've written about the responsibility of the black middle class to take on a leadership role in the movement, and I think that's created some interesting dilemmas in your life. Let me kind of run through a couple of points that you've brought up in your autobiography. Your father died when you were 9, and then your mother remarried eventually. Your stepfather was a doctor. He was very light, and you moved into a predominantly white middle-class neighborhood in Grand Rapids. And from your autobiography, it sounds like that gave you a bit of an identity crisis racially, being in a predominantly white area. And you've written about your acculturation in a white middle-class neighborhood, and how you didn't grow up with easy access to black street language and street style. So that you felt kind of uncomfortable thinking of yourself as like going to work in a storefront ghetto operation or something. You'd feel slightly out of place there culturally.
Oh, there's no question that Grand Rapids in 1944 was hard for me. I mean, it was about as white a place as you could find, and people were not imbued with the sensitivities about race that people have now. It was awfully tough, and I had a lot of pain, and I had a lot of identity problems. American culture is a very powerful culture, and all the images in the culture at that time were white images. You didn't have black people in Life and Look magazines. You didn't have black people in the movies. You barely had black people playing. You didn't have black people playing baseball or football, anything. There were very few blacks in public life who people were led to admire. So what'd you have thrown at you? You had Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams, you had Sid Luckman, you had Robert Taylor and Lana Turner. And it was a tough culture to grow up in. Reflecting on it now, as I am a few weeks away from my 60th birthday, I'm glad it happened. Because I was able to ultimately to make a clear judgment that white people were not superhuman, that I was better than lots of them, I was not as good as some of them, that some were wonderful, some were awful. But I'm not, you know, I think if you grow up away from white people, if you're segregated, it's hard not to buy a little bit of the myth that white people are super people.
My guest is Roger Wilkins, professor at George Mason University and columnist for Mother Jones magazine. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have a decision on the East German Border Guards case. and the opening today of a museum in Germany, which commemorates the beginning of the Holocaust, the first such institution inside Germany. In St. Petersburg, there were expectations that that city would lead the way toward economic reform. Apparently, it's not happening. Here at home, we're going to take a look at the Democratic debate in New Hampshire, politics of bashing the rich, and we're going to hear from a voter in Oregon who's going to help keep us in touch with what's happening in the Northwest, and of course, remembering Martin Luther King.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're talking about the civil rights movement today with Roger Wilkins. I want to get back to the idea of the black middle class having a responsibility to not remove itself from the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of options you see for black middle class people who aren't necessarily going to be leaders of a mass movement, but who want to not just go through personal advancement and separate themselves from the larger movement?
I think that our tradition has been that we have been forced to take care of ourselves for as long as we've been here. We've only had a benign, moderately benign government looking at us since 1965. It's not been entirely benign, but it's been moderately benign. Prior to that, virtually all public policy in the United States was directed against us, against our interests, and designed to disable us from anything, any role in life other than menial, subservient, compliant, cheap labor. And in the face of that, we created churches back in the 18th century. Blacks created a church for themselves because they didn't like to be segregated in the white church in Philadelphia. Blacks participated in the Underground Railroad. Blacks had slave rebellions. After slavery, they created schools. They created normal schools. They created colleges. They created burial associations that grew into insurance companies and banks in order to take care of themselves. Toni Morrison has a great line in her wonderful novel, Beloved, where one character says to another, well, we've been pulling colored people out of the river forever. That's our tradition, pulling colored people out of the river. Well, things have changed in America in very significant ways. We've had more progress in my lifetime than I could have imagined from the vantage point of my childhood. On the other hand, the black poor are devastated by the deindustrialization. Now, the whole economy is devastated by it, but the black poor are isolated. They're away from job networks. There are no institutions of any of any major consequence that serve them well. They are in a terrible fix. They are people who have just been left out of the last half of the 20th century. They live in brutal third world conditions in a first world country which values winners and hates losers regardless of race, but when the losers are black people, the country is absolutely brutal. Well, these people are falling far and farther behind. We're facing a new challenge. Black America has to adapt its old traditions in order to pull these people in. Now, part of what we need to do is what the old leaders continue to do, press hard for the government to provide employment, to provide education, to provide housing. Those are things that black people can't do for themselves. The government has fallen down on the job. It's been awful. The black leaders need to continue to press that. But we need to provide more help to the institutions that help these people. We need to flood the schools with people who can help kids read. I look at these kids when I go into these schools. They're me when I was in Harlem schools. They need to see somebody like me to know that they are worthwhile and that they can achieve. I think middle-class Americans, black Americans, are willing to do it, but nobody's telling them what to do. They're kind of confused. They don't know.
I wonder if you think that because of the growing separation between the middle class and the poor, if there's become something of a culture gap between the two, and if that, that makes it more difficult and more uncomfortable for the middle class to figure out where they belong, in like what they can do in doing something to help the poor.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, look, black people are Americans. We're not, you know, we're not Mexicans. We're not Africans. We're not Canadians. We're Americans. We're exposed to everything that Americans are exposed to. And a lot of what American is individualistic and materialistic. My sense is that, I guess what I'm arguing is that black people have had a richer tradition than individualism and materialism, that we have had a tradition of service. We have had a tradition of giving back. After all, Harriet Tubman freed herself from slavery, went to the North, had skills, could have lived a comfortable life, but instead continued to go back to the South to free other slaves and hired herself out as a seamstress in Philadelphia in order to make money to go back and continue her freedom work. Martin King, in our time, born with the equivalent in our community of a silver spoon in his mouth. His daddy was one of the biggest preachers in town. All Martin had to do was to go to school, become a preacher, and go and be assistant preacher in his daddy's church and someday inherit one of the biggest churches in town and be one of the big-timers. He didn't do that. He got shot for it, but he gave back. Well, the give back, that's what we should... If there's anything to learn from this holiday, which I really think of not just as Martin's Day, but as a day to celebrate all of the people who have participated in all these struggles over the time, it is that the black people have a tradition of giving back. The point of life is to be a useful human being and to make things better than they were when you got here. And so I think that needs to be articulated much more forcefully in our community than it is now.
Well, that's a nice note to leave us with. Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Roger Wilkins is a professor at George Mason University and a columnist for Mother Jones Magazine. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Although many African Americans have been elected to office, many white candidates are almost afraid of being associated with black issues. On the next Fresh Air, the state of black politics and the black vote. We talk with Ron Walters. He's a professor at Howard University who has advised members of the Congressional Black Caucus and Jesse Jackson. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.